Hi, everyone. This is Renee Siebert, and this is the October 2015 LCT cohort. We're doing a class today on coaching ethics. Today's Monday, May 23rd, 2016. Welcome, everybody.
Yay.
It's good to see all of you there.
Thank
Hello.
You.
I would like it, this is a Q&A call, so, you know, without questions posted on the forum, it's more like, you know, what questions do you have, what are things that you've been thinking about since you listened to the recordings or, you know, read the material, but if you all are willing, what I would like to do is just do a quick go around and check in and just give me one word or sentence if you want. Say your name and one word about something that is intriguing or perplexing, confusing, or something you want to know more about with ethics. Anything in general. So intriguing or perplexing, confusing, or something you'd like to know more about. So I'll go down with the ones let me just go down the list. So Katrina, you said hi earlier. What is there anything in particular that is intriguing or fun? Could be fun about it.
So when I was listening to the recording, and I think it's come up before where some of you coaches, this is more than a sentence, I'm sorry. Okay, so like in the initial, like if you have a consultation with a client about whether or not to take them on as a client, I guess I still don't have a handle on what the cues would be as to whether or not they'd be ideal. And like, and then I guess more on just how to gently say no if you think that they're not ideal.
Okay. That's a good one. So cues as to whether or not they're an ideal client, and then if not, then what do you do? How do you gently bring that up? And you know, if you don't feel like you're the right person to work with them.
Right.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That's a great question. Okay, Rachel. Rachel Billingsley, are you on the call? Rachel. Going once. Going twice. Okay, I'll come back. Laurel, how about you? Laurel in Texas.
Sorry, was unmuting myself there.
Okay.
Overall, I found the materials really thorough, and I appreciated, again, lining out the differences between coaches and mentors and therapists, because I find that oftentimes people ask that question. So I appreciated that. It just alerted me to a lot of things that could happen down the road. So it's just nice to know at the beginning what some of those issues would be. So I just appreciated all the info.
Okay, great. Thank you for that feedback. It's really a fun class to teach. Lots of things to think about. But I will say something about that because I start a lot of my coaching contracts with a little something about that. So, how about you, Rachel? Rachel DeBreer? Hope Edelman.
Hi, I'm here. I'm interested in being able to make a distinction between what is truly outside of my abilities and training and what just feels like it is because maybe I haven't encountered it before. And don't feel confident in that area as a coach. So I imagine over time I'll learn how to, you know, understand the distinction, but how to really know it at first, I guess, is one of my questions.
Okay. Great. Okay. That's a really good one. Thank you for that. Okay. Tessa. Tessa here? No. Joanna. Sarah Greenfield. Ada. I think I have the wrong list. No, just kidding. Dee Dee.
I'm here.
Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi. I think I would love to hear more about the mental health side. I do run into, I think people mention, like, being depressed. It's like, as opposed, like, I think it's like a sign, maybe. Like, I had one gentleman, just as an example, really quick, he's very ill. I'm trying to work with him, but he's like, you know, I'm jealous of the friends that I hear that pass away. You know, like the kind of, like, you know, you're depressed. He's not quite suicidal, but it's like, but anyway, I think the mental health right now is, I'm a little wobbly with.
Okay,
and I love the recording. Terry D'Alma did an amazing job being extremely thorough. So I did like the recording.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Yes, that's a really good one. Like, how do you tell what would be sort of normal thoughts for somebody who's ill, and when does it cross the line? Good one. Okay, I like it. Okay, how about Lizelle? What a beautiful name. Lizelle Hill. Adrienne Hillman. And Lisa.
I think so many people have said it well. Developing a screening process around who is a good client and where they are emotionally, suicidal-wise, depression-wise, what's really going on going into it so that I have a clear picture.
Okay, got it. That's a good one. Okay, how about Mary? Mary Houston? Not on the call. Okay. Carrie Hulsing. Kathleen. And Linda?
Hi, I'm here.
Hello.
Hi. I like some of the other questions that have come up. They're great. Maybe just add, I'm curious about transference and countertransference. I think that came up in the material. Just how often does it happen, really? And if you, maybe all the time, but if you're noticing it as a coach, how would you approach it with a client? Or just do you happen to have any examples?
Okay, great. That's a really good one. Love it. Okay, Catherine. Catherine Kleiser. Tiffany? Nicole Flatter. Oh, go ahead. Is that Tiffany?
This is Tiffany, yeah. But I was just going to
say
questions. Hi. The questions that I've had have already been asked, so I'll just listen.
Okay. Okay, great. And Kathy Shaw from Ohio.
Hi. Hi, Renee. I thought it was thorough. I don't have a specific question, but it was a lot of information. I was thinking at the time that we were given a lot of good information that probably wouldn't have dawned on me had we not had the opportunity to listen to that.
Okay, yeah. So it was just like, oh, okay, good to know, mm-hmm. right? Stored away for later. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. We've actually changed our way of doing this, and we're posting all of this info kind of up front, like with the first few classes, to give you a lot more time to read it and listen through it, especially since some people are jumping in right away and seeing clients. So I think that's going to work better in the future, and that's from feedback that people have given us. So we really listen to feedback. It is a lot of info. It's like fire hose, right? I can't drink that much. Okay, how about you, Nicole? Nicole Slatter.
Hey, my question is, it's definitely concerning ethics, but I'm just curious for your perspective from your practice. When you have clients who engage in a month-long program with you, and I specifically work with people on like personal finance journeys and their small businesses, and sometimes I'm coaching them And what they need coaching on is not necessarily always linked to their end goals in those, like, categories of life. And I ethically sometimes am challenged by the fact that they signed up for a month-long program and they want to see these results and they want to see them, you know, sooner than later. But yet the pace at which I do coaching doesn't always lend itself to that. So I feel like the struggle between pushing them to get results, to have, like, you know, some sort of, like, a good feeling about their investment and what they got, but yet, like, sometimes there's just a much longer process than what we typically would think at the outset of a month that we would be able to do. So kind of that push and pull and tug of the client's expectations for how fast things happen and then your ability to actually, like, take them to that result within the time frame that they had anticipated. And, like, how do you manage that ethically, set expectations along the way? Because I don't want to push, but at the same time, you know, you want to show people results and get positive testimonials, and you want all those positive effects, but yet it doesn't always be the case that you would expect.
Right, sure. Okay, that's a really good one.
How do you feel that?
Yeah, because then they're going to come back and say, I didn't get what you said you were going to provide. Got it. Okay, that's a really good one. Okay, good. So, Electra, how about you? So, if people have joined the call, what we're doing is we're just giving a one word or a one sentence about something that intrigued you, something that is either confusing or perplexing, or something you'd want to hear more about for the call today. So, Electra, are you here? How about Meg Wilson? And Kristen?
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Hello.
I was intrigued by the discussion of boundaries, and particularly because I'm wondering, I guess I kind of need to really think about the difference between self-disclosure in a way to connect with somebody and, you know, how much of that, I know it's going to be subjective depending on the situation, but I think some of that can be really helpful, but it was really intriguing, and actually I was surprised at how much I heard from Terry and about that, about, you know, where the line really is between some kind of self-disclosure for connection and also setting boundaries, as in, you know, as was mentioned in the recording. That's what I was intrigued about. And then I want to know more about mentors.
Mentors. Okay, great. Got it. Okay, I'm going to just do a quick Rachel, either Rachel here, Tessa, Joanna, Sarah. Chime in if I call your name. Hi, who's that?
This is Joanna.
Hi, Joanna.
Hi.
Anything?
I would like to get a bit more information on identifying persons who may be suicidal.
Okay.
Now, I have had a client, well, I didn't make them my client, someone approached me asking to coach their daughter, but then when I asked questions, I realized that her daughter had tried to commit suicide. So immediately I said no. So that's why I'm a bit, you know, interested in how to identify persons who may not have tried, but, you know, have no suicidal tendency. Yeah.
Yes, gotcha. Okay, that's a really good question. Thank you. Let's see, Sarah, Ada or Lucelle or Adrienne, are you here?
Hi, this is Ada. I'm here.
Hi there.
Hi.
Anything intriguing or confusing or something you'd want to know more about?
Sure. I'd love to actually know a little bit more about, I don't have a niche yet in terms of where I would like to practice coaching, but I assume for like my practice coaching, I'm really just reaching out to my social network. And so, you know, a lot of the people are probably acquaintances or closer friends. And I'd like to know a little bit more about, I think, the boundaries between somebody who might be your friend or close to you and coaching them. And then also I'm a little confused as to some of the free coaching calls that would be offered, like a consultation, and what would be the real difference between that and, like, say, your first sort of session with a client.
Got it. Okay, that's a good question, really good question. Okay, we got good stuff to talk about. Just a quick call out, Mary, Carrie, or Kathleen, or Catherine, Electra, or Meg, weigh in if you'd like to.
This is Carrie. I'm here, but I don't have any specific questions.
Okay, glad to see you here. Thanks for being here. Okay, well, let's kind of take it from the top. And a couple of these might be a good one to practice a little ethical decision-making model, because I want to make sure that we have time to cover that. So the ideal client and the first consultation, first session, maybe we could kind of hit those together. So the free consultation might be a way to discover that, you know, why the person was interested in you, what their issues are, and, you know, whether or not as you're talking and you're checking in with your body compass and your experience and, you know, what your desire is to coach around, you know, if those match. So I do offer a 30-minute discovery session. I didn't used to, but I find it more and more helpful now because I get a little bit of some of my questions answered about what the person is interested in. And, you know, like somebody could send me an email or call me and say I'm interested in career coaching. So, you know, what might come to my mind might be completely different than what that person is thinking of when they use those words, career coaching. And I do executive coaching and leadership development. So, you know, what does that mean? So let me give you an example. I had a client referred to me, actually, for career coaching from a therapist that knows me, and they're both in another state, so it would be phone coaching. And so I knew the person was already in therapy working through some relationship issues because the person was a, you know, relationship therapist. So when she first got on the phone with me for the first 30-minute discovery, she said, okay, I'm sending you my resume. I have two different ones, and I'd really like you to take a look at them and, you know, help me figure out if they're going to do what I need them to do because I want to move to another state and start a whole new career. I was like, oh, my goodness. So, you know, the first thing I said is I'm not a resume expert. I'm willing to look at your, you know, resume and give you feedback once I get to know you a little bit. But that is not what I do. And, you know, let me get a little bit more information about what you think you need in coaching. So then we got on to some of the real deeper issues. You know, she's working with the relationship coach because the relationship therapist because her relationship has had some real struggles and they're not sure they want to move forward. She's sure she wants to go to another state and get, you know, a completely different life started. So that was my opportunity to introduce her to the four squares, you know, just give her a little snippet of information and ask her where she thought she might fall in the relationship category and where she might fall in the career category. So, you know, in the relationship category, she was really deeply in square three trying to figure out how to make things work or not. In the career and move category, she was barely starting square two with dreaming and scheming. She didn't even really know where she wanted, you know, what kind of work she wanted to do. She just knew she didn't want to be an attorney anymore, you know, in
in the way she had been being an attorney. So, you know, describing to her what kind of things we could do with square two and square three for her, you know, her search was more about her getting clear about what she wanted to do and who she wanted to be. So for me, you know, then weighing that against, I do, you know, executive coaching. I've been through Brené Brown's training on Daring Greatly. I felt like it was a really nice match, and I just kind of outlined to her what I thought we could work on. And this relates a little bit to what you were asking, Nicole. You know, I knew that this was going to take us a little while. So she bought a package with me, and, you know, three or four sessions in, she's really frustrated because she's, you know, trying for jobs and not getting them because it takes a while, and she's still getting clear on what she wants to do. So, you know, those three things are really related. And so I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think Terry might have said she doesn't do discovery sessions at all. And that's one of the things about ethics and running your business in general is, you know, what works for me might not feel right for you. So if you have a really clear sense of who you are and what you offer and who your ideal client is, and that's really upfront in your materials, and even in a first phone call when somebody wants to schedule an appointment, it's really easy to be able to say, like I could have said, I do leadership and executive development for people that are already in their organization. I don't do career coaching for people who are trying to find a job, but I can give you a few referrals for that because that's not my expertise. And, you know, I could have done that with her. She's now asking questions about using headhunters and other things. And that's not my area of expertise, but I am doing research on behalf of her so I can answer some questions and point her in the right direction. And I'm a total fact finder, so that feels fine to me, but might not fit for everyone. So with regard, Nicole, to your question, one of the things that came to mind was the informed consent sort of process. So if you're offering a month-long or kind of a standard program, some of the things that you might put it may not be like an informed consent that they sign per se, but might be in the first class to say, these are some things I want to just lay out there for you. You know, this is a really fast-paced program. And most of you have signed up with an end goal in sight, and I want to let you know up front that everybody does this in their own time frame. Some of you at the end will have, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, you'll be at a 9. Some of you will be halfway there. And the reason you might be halfway there, the reasons are varied. You know, they may be because other issues are going to pop up throughout this program that are blocks for you, and that's where I might recommend that you, in addition to this program about getting your finances going or in order or whatever however you call it, you might need a coach on the side to help you get out of your own way. And you can say, you know, I know about this because I've been there. So that way you can set it up ahead of time and plant the seed so that when you have to make an additional phone call to somebody and say, here's what I'm sensing. You know, this might be something that's holding you back. Tell me where I'm wrong. And, you know, how deeply do you want to work on this and get this out of the way so that you can accomplish what you set out to in this program. And, you know, just lay it out there, be authentic. It's an invitation to them. They may not take it up, but at least you've given them a heads up as to why they're at the 5 mark instead of the 9.
Yeah. That sounds
so
good.
That way you've really set up front what they could expect and what might happen and what might derail them.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just check in with each of you. So Katrina and Nicole and was it Ada that asked that? about the free consultation. What questions do you all have on that after I've just talked for a little bit about those three things?
Renee, this is Nikki.
Yep.
About the informed consent form, was there, did we have an example of that? Because I know we had the intake forms, but for an informed consent form, is there any sort of like a template or organization of that, or is it just kind of a paragraph, almost disclosure?
I'm pretty certain that in your setting up shop class, those coaches have put out several different versions for you to look at, and I've looked at all of those. And they all have info in there about, you know, confidentiality and when that might have to be breached in terms of safety. So if there's something specific that when you look at those and you're creating your own,
that you want to
ask Terry or I about, we're totally available to you guys, you know, on an ongoing basis by email or in the Facebook page or, so, you know, take a look at those and then see. And, you know, I kind of have a combination information and consent. So in mine, I talk about the difference between coaching and counseling. And I feel for me that's really important because I also have a therapy license and used to be practice as a therapist, and I don't anymore. I make it really clear that now I'm a coach and I don't have a therapy practice. There are a lot of people that do both still, and there's ways to do that and great guidelines on that and books that are written if anybody's attempting that. But I just, you know, my preference right now is to work with, you know, pretty well-functioning people that want to set goals or get their leadership and, energy together and things like that. And I do a lot of Equus coaching. Even, like, I have a couple of contracts right now that come out for equine sessions where the clients are in a treatment program, but I made it clear in my contract that I'm not doing equine therapy. I'm doing Equus coaching and kind of outlined that to make sure that, you know, people really understood that when they contracted with me. All right. So I'm going to move on to a couple of other things. So, Laurel, you mentioned, you know, coach, mentor, therapist. That's another thing that you can kind of outline a little bit in your info sheet or your informed consent. But when I was coaching a group of college students recently with a contract that I had, and I really started out my first session going through, you know, I want to make sure that you and I both are clear on our definitions and what is the difference between coaching, mentoring, counseling, and advising, and consulting. And so I just kind of ran through, you know, in my mind, you know, counseling is for people who were really, you know, at a certain level of functioning, and then for some reason they're not right now. Their energy is low, they may be depressed or feeling hopeless, or they have sleep or appetite problems. They're just not feeling the same kind of joy. And, you know, they may be having thoughts of hurting themselves. So that person really needs a therapist or counselor. A coach, you know, is for somebody that is functioning well and going along with their life, and they want to take themselves to the next level, just like an athletic coach. And then I kind of go through, especially for like a college student, I wanted to make sure in their mind, you know, I've been through college and I've had to make some choices about internships and things like that. So because I do have experience, you may look at me as a mentor, and that, you know, you have some at your college that you could access. And there may also be an advisor at your college that's going to actually say, I think you should do this. And I said that a coach typically doesn't do that. My job is to ask you questions to help you figure out what you really, truly want to do and verify and validate that you're capable and able of doing that if you want to. And then a consultant is somebody that's really hired because they have had a lot of experience and can help you, you know, design a website or open up a startup or a software company or, you know, a treatment program. So I have had jobs as a consultant where they really want me to take a look at everything they're doing and what are they missing and that sort of thing. And that's more of a consulting role and just making sure that people understand the difference between those. And Hope, this kind of touches on your question about, you know, when are you outside of your abilities and the difference checking in with yourself, is this a confidence thing or is it a competence thing? And if it's a competence thing, can I do some fact-finding to inform myself as to how to help the client? Or am I just worried that I'm, you know, going to take the person down the wrong road or something like that? And so it's partially a self-assessment of what is your life experience, what are the tools you can use. We're all going to feel a little shaky the first time we use, the first or second or third time we use some of the tools, and that's just normal. I'm often, when I get ready to be on a call, if there's somebody I'm working with where I feel like I might be a little out of my league. So let me give you an example. Most of my career was in healthcare before I became a coach. I worked in treatment centers and, you know, had a private practice and things like that. And when I became a coach and joined a coaching firm, I had a fair amount of experience coaching teams, team building, leadership development in healthcare. But we had a big client organization that was in finance, like CPAs and CFOs and things like that. And I got to tell you, I was pretty terrified because I felt like I don't know that industry very well. But in actuality, when I got into it and, you know, I was open with another co-facilitator that I worked with that my confidence was shaky with this. And once I got in there, I realized the things that came up in the individual coaching and the things that came up with the team are pretty universal. You know, people are people. We have our own human armor on, as Brené Brown would say it. And, you know, the armor is what we're working on in terms of helping people be connected with each other. And the shields that we put up are very similar when we're stressed out. And and the teams, the dynamics are the same in almost every industry. The issues they're talking about are a little bit different. But once I got honest with myself about being able to separate the people from the issues, I did fine. So in that regard, the confidence, I mean, I still check myself and coach myself and call my own mentor coach sometimes when I'm thinking, what am I doing here? I mean, I've been doing this a long time and I still have those feelings once in a while. So, and anytime you take on something new, it's the same thing of, okay, I'm going to go walk into this arena, as Brené Brown says, you know, who, what's my theme song that I need to be playing and who are up there in the cheap seats and the box seats that are going to be the critical voices in my head? And am I being self-compassionate as I do that? So, you know, that's the work that we all continue to do as we step into the arena of coaching and taking on clients. If I feel like it's really outside of my ability, or way outside of my competence, I think just being really authentic is the way to go. This is really outside of my own experience and expertise, and I think you'd really be better served with somebody who has a lot more experience in this area. And if you'll give me a day or two, I can get you some referrals. And just really be matter-of-fact about it. So let me just stop for a second, see if you have questions or comments on that, especially Hope or Laurel. How's that sitting with you? And did I answer the question?
This is Hope. Yeah, that was a great answer. Thank you so much, Renee. And I also get the sense, because I coach in two areas, and in one area I have a base of experience of a couple of decades. I feel really confident there, like I can deal with almost anything that comes up because I mentor in that field as well. But in mm-hmm. the second field, the which is more life coaching, I guess that's where I feel shaky. And so I'm hoping that I'll just gain the confidence over time. I guess you become a coach by doing more coaching, right? And then you feel like a coach.
Right,
so,
exactly.
I'm in that space now where I need to just coach myself or have a peer coach me on my own confidence in that area. I'm not sure that it's – I like what you said about confidence versus competence because
uh-huh.
I might,
yeah.
in fact, be competent but not yet feel confident. So I'll work on sorting that out. Thank you.
Yeah, and let me add one other one to the list because – and this comes from my leadership coaching when I'm helping people deal with performance problems. I often say, you know, is it a competence issue, meaning do they need to be trained, or is it a sort of a capacity issue, like all the training in the world isn't going to help them, or is it a willingness issue? So for us, you know, there's confidence and competence, and then also like willingness. Is this something you're passionate about working with somebody on? And if not, am I taking this on because I feel like I should as a coach, either for money or, you know, because somebody referred them to me? So I've got to be honest with myself about that at the get-go. If I'm taking somebody on because I think I should, there's the path will be wrought with rocks in my way. But, I mean, you still can do that, but the honesty with myself along the way is going to be important there. So confidence, and go ahead.
I'm sorry. I have a question related to that, Renee. I'm not sure that it's really about ethics, but it sort of is. I read in the materials, you know, if you're in question, consult with an ethics instructor, and you mentioned something about mentoring, and I'm just wondering, I don't know if I've seen this in the materials or heard it talked about before, but once we finish the program, what kind of access do we have to this sort of advice when we need it? Are we paired with instructors that we can feel free to contact if we have trouble? I know there's no formal supervision program that I'm aware of, but how do we get feedback as these issues arise when we first start coaching?
Well, great question. Anything that's an ethics question, Carrie and I are available free of charge to you. Just send an email, pick up the phone and call, put a question on the forum, on the Facebook page. That's a really good place if you can without, you know, divulging any specific issues or, you know, confidentiality pieces, because everybody can learn. So that's a place where a lot of people will weigh in and, you know, sort of give their two cents for you to think about. Let me give you an example that might help. A coach put a question on the forum about, a business sort of a question. And several people weighed in. Well, this is how I do it in my business. This is how it's. So there's a way of getting input from people that are already out there doing it without actually having to pay a mentor. If you want some ongoing, quote, supervision mentoring, any of the master coaches would be happy to sign on for two or three sessions or however many you think you need to really sort through some things and get clear for yourself. And there are also folks that have programs that will really be helpful. So after I finished my master coach training, I signed up for, I think it was either 6 months, and then we extended it for a year, but with Michelle Woodward, who is a leadership coach, and she took 12 people in a group, and, you know, we met on the phone for a year, and I got so many of my questions answered. We were all at different places in our business, but we were all doing coaching, and I can't tell you how valuable that was to me to be able to have other people to be able to confidentially say, okay, here's what I'm doing, and I think I suck at it, whatever, right? Or I'm really afraid.
So that was a group that paid the master coach to continue on or do that with them, because after this program, I just don't really think I can afford the investment in one-on-one coaching as I'm trying to build a business. But if you're saying there's the possibility of master coaches maybe doing groups with us in the future, that's certainly something that might be helpful. Thank you for letting me know about
that. Totally. Yeah, and there are other Facebook groups that you could put out there in the big Martha Beck group and say, are there any specific Facebook groups for business coaching, for example? And yes, there is. There's a business of coaching group that Michelle Woodward set up in Facebook, and people put their questions to each other. Martha Atkins has a whole private group for grief and death and dying coaches. And so if you put out there what you need, you know, I'm working in the area of wellness. I'm working in the area of women in leadership. There will be a group that you can join that will be really helpful, and that you can put questions out there. I'm working with people who have lived through depression. You know, where do I get resources for that? Ask, put it out there and ask, because there are people that might start a group just to answer questions, or might start a small group for sort of a regular check-in. If you're thinking it, you're probably not the only one, so I think it's great to put it out there. Okay, Lamina, let's talk about the mental health, the depressed, suicidal, how do you know when to refer. The one handout that talks about indications, guidelines for referring to a licensed mental health professional has a lot of good information in there. And those are some specific questions you can really ask somebody if you're in an ongoing coaching already and you get the feeling that that they're starting to feel more hopeless or down. So that's one thing, which is you've already got the relationship, and then you can start saying, I'm really concerned about some of what I'm hearing in your voice, or if you're doing face-to-face, you know, I'm concerned about what I'm seeing. I want to talk for a few minutes and just make sure that you're okay and that we don't need to call in some extra help for both of us. And I usually do an us thing, because I'm being clear that it might be out of what I'm able to do in our sessions or willing to do. That we might need extra help. If you're trying to assess when you're first starting out, one of the ways to do that, and you may or may not get an honest answer because people have a lot of shame around mental health issues, but I typically ask, have you ever been seen or treated for any mental health conditions? And I call them conditions, not disorders, just because that's my own little bias. I wish they would have called the book Conditions instead of Disorders from the DSM. But I ask outright, have you ever been in counseling or therapy or treatment? If so, when? You know, how did it go? What was the best thing you got out of that? And that usually will open up the door for them to talk a little bit about what worked for them. And then I can bring up the question, you know, how would you know if that was happening again, if you started to spiral back into that? And be honest and say, I'm asking because I would want to be paying attention to that with you and for you. And I want to make sure that it's okay that I bring that up if I see that happening. Another thing that is, I think, very useful is to ask them when they say, I'm depressed, tell me what that means to you when you say you were depressed. And then I can ask, was it diagnosed by a professional, and how did they do that? And this is my bias around that, and this is just my own opinion, so feel free to jump in. The television and the mass media has all this information out there about depression, and patients are going to their doctors and saying, I'm depressed, because I have this, this, and this. And the physicians, because they're fairly well trained and they're able to do this, they write prescriptions. It doesn't necessarily mean that the person had a full-on mental health assessment by somebody that was really looking for the nuances and really seeing if the diagnosis fit. So that's just my own bias. And so a lot of people will say, yes, I was depressed. And, you know, I had medication and here's what happened. And I need to know that. And then I want to know, were you in treatment or was your, you know, regular physician giving you medication? You know, what was it? So that I can see, was it something that the symptoms were just treated or the person was treated in an ongoing way? And what do they think was helpful about that? And where do they see themselves now? And just really asking a lot of questions around that. And why do you think coaching would be helpful now versus counseling? And talk about the differences between the two and really check into your body compass about the answers that you're hearing. A couple of times I've said to a person, you know, it sounds like we could do some work with coaching. However, just because of my own concern, would it be all right for me to ask you to go and just get an assessment with somebody local in your community so somebody there knows you, and then we can take a look at what that assessment shows and what they recommend, and it might be counseling first and then come back to me, or it might be something simultaneous, or, you know, it might just be we're good to go and we can start coaching, because some of the things that are going to come up in coaching might, you know, in some ways trigger some of the past stuff. And I want to make sure that we're both on the same, wavelength, the same walking path, and that we have resources right there in your town where somebody knows you. And especially when doing phone coaching, that makes me feel a little more comfortable because I can't see the person. Or, you know, if I'm not doing Zoom meetings with them. But the other thing that I really like to rely on is, what is their own sense? What's their inner guidance telling them? Because they're the expert in their own life, and I really want to know what they think. And that there may be some reasons why they want coaching versus counseling, because they're really ready to get out of their own way and look at some of these, you know, reasons why they're armored up and shielded up and want connection in the world. And maybe back then the illness is what was part of that, and they want to be past that. So it's a combination of being really clear on what you are interested in hearing, and then the confidence to authentically and very matter-of-factly asking it with a compassionate tone. So we can ask the hardest questions in the world with the right compassionate tone. And, you know, if that's in your heart as a coach, it's going to come right through. And it's not going to be, you know, hopefully shaming or triggering or any of that to the client. And hopefully they'll be really honest with you. And just knowing that, you know, thoughts of suicide for a person who really feels like they're at the end of their rope is a way out of the pain for that person. And so, you know, asking questions around it, all the research says it doesn't make it worse and it doesn't make it more likely to happen. It makes it more likely for the person to understand that it's okay to talk about it, and it's okay to get help for it. So let me just check in with Lisa and Joanna, and a couple other people had questions about that piece. What's coming up for you as we talk that through? Go ahead.
Hi, this is Joanna. I think you pretty much elaborated on it, and I understand what you're feeling. It's really about checking in with yourself and asking the client as many questions as possible. So I think that will help me a lot. Thank you. Thanks.
think you were either breaking up or we lost you. So if you come back
I'm on Skype, so I think you're giving a bit of trouble today. But thank you. I understood what you were saying. Thank you.
Okay, great. So what I heard you say was that it's a lot about asking questions and getting as much information as you can and then trusting your body compass. And, you know, checking in with a mentor. We've had many questions on the Facebook page around these areas, and, you know, people will give input about what they think, and at the end of the day, though, we're the ones that have to live with our decisions. So this ethical decision making model, I think, is really helpful to work it through. And if you guys can maybe pull that out, I want to make sure we have a little bit of time to go through that. Let me just take a quick look at the question and make sure. Oh, there were two others that I want to talk about. And let me think if we could. We might do the boundaries issue with the model. So let me just, Linda, to get back to transference, counter-transference. Could you tell me a little bit more about your question on that? You said, how often does it happen, and what are your other thoughts about?
The topic was made me curious. In my own previous career in a corporate setting, I would notice when I was managing people that in certain cases, I might start feeling like they're treating me like a parent. Or I noticed that I've, in certain ways, treated bosses in my life as a parent in ways that I was, you know, not even necessarily conscious of. And that's just one example of one kind of a role. And so when the materials pointed to that, I was curious about it. I thought, I could imagine that happening. And the different therapists and professionals I've worked with, I definitely have often had them on a pedestal, or the information that they give, I put a lot of weight in it, and that's kind of the point, right? I mean, I'm going to them to help me work with something, and so their advice can, you know, carry some weight, and there's times when I've noticed a bit of transference happening, or, you know, in terms of that dynamic. So it just, it just made me curious, like, and did you have any examples of it, or, you know, if it's something that you notice where, you know, hey, are you treating me like your mother here, or like, or does it just come up in thought work and you work through it as you would any other limiting belief? That's all.
It's a great, great question. By way of making sure everybody's on the same page with us who's on the call. The transference is when the client's feelings from some other significant person in their life is being transferred onto us. And it's really normal, and it happens a lot because, I mean, the more I understand projection, we're all doing it. Everything in our life that we are, you know, because our brain is really patterned to find ways to make sense out of the world, and we rely on our past experiences to do that. So our brain's constantly working to find a template that this will fit, and the template is usually from our past experience or partially, and then we fill in the blanks of what's not there. And, you know, if you've read Rising Strong, Brené Brown, she talks about, you know, in research, when we know some of the facts, but we don't know all of them, we filled in some of the other. Now it's a hypothesis, but it's actually also a conspiracy theory that we're trying to prove or disprove. When we don't have any facts at all and we make it all up, it's a confabulation. And a confabulation is really a lie told with the complete belief that it's true, right? So this is happening all the time in the world and in our relationships. So it's very likely that there will be some transference from the client onto us. And sometimes it's running a parallel to something that's happening with us as well. That's a whole different class. But I'm always attracting into my life and into my practice things that I need to work on, or they wouldn't be showing up. So that's that whole projection thing. Transference in and of itself is not like a good or a bad thing. It can really be helpful if the transference is positive, like I look like their most favorite Aunt Bessie. You know, that can really, you know, the person can immediately have a connection with me without a lot of work on the relationship. On the other hand, even that positive thing then could come up when, like, the person thinks they're going to disappoint me if they don't do well in my program or in our coaching. So that's where the thought work will really be helpful, you know, working through those limiting beliefs. Counter-transference is something that we really need to pay attention to. And that is when, you know, we are having feeling towards a client or getting emotionally entangled with them. So you can think of it in two ways. One would be sort of red flag diagnostic, let's use that word. In other words, I'm getting a feeling about somebody that is a red flag because I know that feeling, like somebody might be abusive or violent or really have mental illness, for example. Like, you get that uh-oh feeling. I always pay attention to my uh-oh feeling. It's deep in my stomach, and I feel it with certain people. It's a really nice cautionary reminder for myself to take a look at why is this happening? What do I not know? What am I missing? So those can be really helpful. When counter-transference, you know, takes a right turn is when I get entangled because it's a blind spot, or I'm not setting the same kind of boundaries with a person because I really have started to care about them too much. I mean, I don't know how you can care about anybody too much, but in a way that would take me away from objective reasoning and objective reasonable care with my client. So one of the questions I would ask myself if I start to notice that is, okay, would I do this with everyone, with every single client? And if it's a no, then I need to find out, okay, why? Why am I doing this? Why am I making an exception for them to pay me later versus every other client I expect them to pay me up front? Or, you know, I'm doing extra email sessions with this particular person. Why am I doing that when I don't do that with anyone else? So that's a great barometer for me, that somehow I've kind of stepped into, I'm treating this person a little differently than others. Why is that? Why am I moving my boundary line a little bit with this person? And it's not necessarily to get into a big critical beating myself up match. It's just it's a checkpoint and say, what's happening here? And you all have probably throughout the course gotten close to some buddies, and that's really helpful ongoing. The folks I went through with my life coach training, I'm still really close to one person, and master coach, probably four or five. And in necklace coaching, I have sort of a circle of four or five people, and I pick up the phone and say, okay, here's what's happening, without any names or details. Here's where I'm feeling tangled up, you know, permission to coach me. And so we have this sort of peer relationship with each other. It's really clear that I'm wanting some assistance. That's different than me starting to coach a friend and not telling them that I'm doing that. You know, that's in more of in the no-no category. And it kind of touches on your question, Ada, about coaching friends. But our friends from the coaching world in the tribe can become valued sort of peer consultants, so to speak, to be able to say to each other, this is out of my league too. It would be great to call one of the master coaches at this point and just run it by them. So hopefully that gives you a little snippet on those two. Linda, what are you thinking as I talk that through?
That was helpful. That's interesting and makes a lot of sense. So that's great. Thanks.
Okay, great. Yeah, so the positive side is it can tell me something about the person, and on the other side it could mean I'm in a blind spot or I'm getting entangled and I need to kind of think about that. So how often does it happen? Probably more than we think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's specifically why when we're talking about boundaries with coaching acquaintances, Ada, this might get back to your question. If I'm going through training and my friends are clear that I want to practice the tools that I'm learning, would you be willing to go through a tool with me? That's pretty upfront and clear, and, you know, maybe a few words about, and if something comes up that opens something up, you know, I'll do the best I can as your friend or your family member, and I'm going to be willing to honestly say this is something that coaching could really help, and that probably might not be me. But for practicing the tool, are we both sort of clear on our relationship here and practicing the tool? So that's one boundary with as you're learning and training. If a friend or acquaintance wanted you to be their coach and they're going to pay you, that would be a great thing to walk through the ethical decision-making model and think that through about, okay, what are my concerns? What might happen if I do this? What are the consequences? And what are my different options that I could do? So let's take a look at the model. Does anybody have a specific, even if it's a small thing where they were like, I'm not sure I know what to do here, that we could walk through really quickly? Somebody that wanted you to coach them on a certain thing or something where you knew a family member, anything like that, that we could just use to walk it through. So much easier than making something up. I want you to think for a minute so we could find a good scenario. I think, you know, Joanna, yours on the suicidal daughter, I think that one's a little really specifically clear on you'd want to make sure to find out if that had been discussed with a mental health counselor, and that might be a better one, you know, to just refer right off the bat. But let's say if anybody doesn't, does anybody have one that you could think of? Any kind of issue that might...
Hey, Renee, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Oh, good. I've been trying to press mute five mute or star, and I didn't realize you could hear me.
I can hear you. Who is this?
It's Mary in the UK.
Hi, Mary in the UK.
Hi. I, like, recently, especially, I frequently, with my family, come up against the feeling that coaching would really help you with this. And I meet, you know, with resistance from them. And it kind of does leave this, this sense of conflict that's sort of in the air because they don't really have that much interest, but I think coaching will help them, and the issues are affecting our relationship. And so I'd be really interested to whether that's a valid or relevant example or not as to, you know, sort of with regards to ethics, you know, how do you proceed when it's affecting the dynamics of your relationship.
Yeah, so this is sort of an immediate family member that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's not necessarily an ethical issue for you as a coach. It's more of a relational issue for you as you grow as a person and you're seeing some of the benefits and growth that you've had and you know that could be helpful to them. So as a member of the family, pointing that out and, you know, letting them know your concerns about them and what you think would be helpful is beautiful and appropriate and caring and all of that. The thought that, you know, that they need coaching or that it is affecting your relationship, my hunch is that would be better served by some thought work for you to work through, to think about, you know, or how much in their business are you in? I think for all of us going through this as we grow, we're going to see that more and more in our circle, in our family, in our relationships, and it is going to be hard to watch people struggle and not reach out and get help that they could. And when it's our own family, it's just such a fine line of allowing that and letting it happen in their own time. Now, taking care of yourself in the process is really important, and speaking your truth and being authentic is also important. And then self-coaching around your disappointment when they don't do something about it, and if it takes you to a decision of spending less time with those people. I know Martha in the Integrity Cleanse talked about that a lot, about how we, if we're really checking in with our own integrity, we'll find that we're spending less and less time with people who aren't really working on themselves, because it's painful to us to watch that. And I can be loving and compassionate. Brené Brown talks about this too with trust building and boundaries. She has an acronym called Braving. And it's really about checking in with ourselves. And one piece of that is the integrity piece. And how much time do I want to be spending with this person when it's creating a lot of my own pain and suffering around them not moving forward? You know, that said, I don't know if this is a romantic relationship or if it's, you know, sisters, brothers, things like that, but in a long-term romantic relationship or marriage, there are many times when, because of something I've gone through, I get catapulted through growth. And if you imagine two people walking along a path and all of a sudden me, this one person, is way ahead of the other person, that's a tough point to be in, because, you know, I can make myself believe that they're never going to catch up and I got to get out of here, or I can be really gentle and make the most generous assumption about that person and allow for them to have time to catch up with me, and vice versa. You know, many relationships break up over this issue, and bringing it up is step one, and then letting it sit for a while would be step two, and then continuing to be authentic about it. I don't know if that's helpful, Mary, or not. I'm just talking off the top of my head.
Yeah, so I came in late to the call because I was putting my son to bed, so I very well have missed this covered in the start of the call, and I apologize if I do, but I'm sort of like what's coming up for me is this fine line between integrity and ethics, and where does that boundary cross? It sounds like so much of making, you know, good ethical decisions, creating an ethical practice, comes from many, many steps of our own integrity.
Right. Yeah, and no, you're right. And to really separate out my own personal ethics, morals, values, and when something's bumping up against that versus professionally what I will be held responsible for, how I will be seen with my decisions regarding client relationships. So when we use the word ethics in this ethics coaching class, we're really talking about relationships that are with clients where they come to us for, you know, specifically for professional coaching. And they're closely related because my own personal ethics, morals, and values enter into any other decisions I make professionally. And if I go against my own personal morals and ethics in a professional setting, that's not going to feel good to me. That's going to be really not great. But you would never be held ethically responsible for something, you know, in that's not in a professional relationship, a therapeutic relationship, so to speak. However, checking it against your own morals and values and body compass is key to living in integrity in life and in relationships. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think the big thing for me in the ethics framework was that the question or the statement where it asks you to come consider if there was anything that comes up in your coaching practice that you wouldn't feel comfortable coming out in the light of day, then
that's key.
Be flagging something for you. Yeah.
Right. So let's walk through the model just since I want to make sure if you guys have any questions. But this is a model that I brought to Terry, and I've been using this for years in teaching supervision and ethics and stuff, you know, in other facets of my life, and we recreated it for coaching. So I love this, and I use it a lot, especially when somebody comes to me with kind of a dilemma, and I want to remain really objective. But it's really helpful if you are going to call a mentor or work through a particular question to have filled out some of this yourself. So if you ever call me, I'll say, have you filled out the model yet? And we'll do it together if you haven't. But if nobody has a specific client issue, and it's not going to be any fun if I just talk. I want you guys to chime in. So let's imagine that you are coaching a woman. Let's say it's a woman. And you've had a coaching relationship with her, and she would like for you to see her daughter. And her daughter's been acting out because there's been a divorce, let's say, and she's kind of pitting the parents against each other, and the mother really loves the coaching that you do and wants you to coach her daughter. So let's just walk quickly through the model. The facts, I kind of just gave them to you, but what else would you want to know from the mom in order to fill in this question of do I have all the facts? What would you need to know from the mom to start making a good decision about whether or not you would even consider coaching the daughter? What would you like to know? Just put your curiosity hat on and chime in.
Renee, this is Nikki. I would want to know a little bit more about her daughter's mental state, mental health, and also her daughter's receptivity to even talking to a coach. Has mom talked to her about this? Does she have any openness to it? And then, yeah, what is her overall state of health, and maybe even if she's in school, you know, how things are going there, as well as this showing up in any other areas for her?
Excellent questions. Right. Is it showing up in other areas? Is she receptive? Would this be like you're going to get coaching versus she's open to it? Yeah. Anyone else think of something? What else would you want to know? Go ahead, Kristen. Go first.
No, that wasn't me, but go ahead.
It was Mary, sorry.
Okay. Go ahead, Mary, sorry.
I'd be interested to understand the mother's desire or
motives is too strong a word, but yeah, why, yeah, the mother's real desire behind getting the daughter in.
Yeah, that's a good one. What is the real desire? Great question. Love it. Someone else was chiming in too. Go ahead.
I was thinking this probably wouldn't be the first question I'd ask, but I would want to make sure that the mother understood confidentiality and feel clear that the mother was not suggesting this as a means to use me to find out what's going on with her daughter, but have the mother understand that this would be a confidential relationship between myself and her daughter, and that her daughter could be free to tell her what happens in the sessions, but that would not be something I could do.
Excellent question. Yeah, I love that. Okay, good. Anyone else on the facts? What else you want to make sure?
It's Kristen, and I would probably just ask a basic question like, how old is she?
Yeah, okay, yeah. How old is she? And is it even in my comfort zone to coach somebody that age, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting back to when the question of mental health, was there any kind of mediation or involvement with other professionals during the divorce, right? Does she already have a relationship with somebody else? Would be a good question, I think, too. I'm going to throw one in. So, like, previous experience with a professional. Okay, so the who. Go ahead. Sorry.
Can I get Mary again? And this is kind of personal experience throwing this one in, but I'd also want to know who the daughter lived with, what kind of parenting arrangements there were as a consequence of the divorce.
Yes, parenting arrangements. And who does she live with, and is she going back and forth?
And because, I mean, again, that may well be embroiled in the motives and desires of getting the daughter in for coaching. And, yeah, that's
exactly
going that way.
Great. Okay, and then let's go to the who. So we've kind of already established there's a mom and a daughter. There might be, you know, the other parent. So mom, daughter, other parent. Who else might be impacted by the decision if you were to decide to see her or not see her? Who else do we want to consider as we make our decision here together? I'm thinking maybe other siblings that I might want to know about, right?
Mm.
Is it just this one that's singled out if there's more than one, and why is that? And then, you know, under this category, who could be impacted is also me as the coach, right? Because if I make a decision that goes, well, nothing's a problem, but if I make a decision that gets myself in trouble, me and my reputation might be impacted, right? So I want to consider, you know, am I paying attention to myself in this scenario? So let's go on to the concerns. The concerns in my mind are things like ethics, confidentiality, safety, things like that. So somebody's already brought up confidentiality, which is an excellent point. Does the parent understand that, and, you know, I want to make sure I go into that if I decide to even talk to the daughter once, right? What else about the concerns? Are there any ethical issues here besides confidentiality?
Whether she's on medication.
Okay, so if she's in treatment or meds, that's a definite concern.
What about concerning the other parent, like
right
mission from the other parent?
Exactly. If it's a minor, and you know they're sort of going to enter into a professional relationship, there's a whole informed consent issue, and some states and some other countries have different rules about that. For example, in Florida, both parents have to consent for any kind of consultation or treatment. In other states, it's in America, it's the guardian that has physical custody. In some states, they actually stipulate you know, physical custody versus sort of consent for other kinds of things like buying a car or things like that. So what are the ramifications of this parent bringing her in without the other one knowing? Great thing to think about. Anything else?
What if the daughter says something in a session that makes, that affects your relationship with the mother?
Yes, that's definitely a thought to have. What if I find out information about my client that I've been seeing that I didn't know? How will that impact our relationship? And how will we negotiate that? Good one. One that I'd like to add to this list that's not on the bullet points is blind spot. Is this a blind spot for me? Have I been through a divorce? Is it recent? Did I have kids that, you know, reacted during the divorce? Is there any ways where, I mean, sometimes that's a real experience expertise issue because I'm going to think of things that maybe the mom isn't, but it also could be a blind spot depending on how much work I've done through it and where am I in that process? Am I now an expert who coaches families like this and I feel really good about my objectivity, or is this going to be potentially triggering for me? That's something I want to consider. Okay, now as we go through the options and consequences, we might come back and fill some more in, but I think you guys have hit on some really important ones about confidentiality, other professionals that might be involved, or treatment of the other parent, disclosure issues, which reminds me, I don't think I talked about self-disclosure. I want to get back to that question. I'm sorry, I forgot that. If you're still on the call, we'll get back to that. Okay, options. Most of the time when people have an ethical dilemma, they often feel like there's really only one thing I can do. You know, because there's a confidentiality potential here or something I might learn, I've just immediately got to say no. Not so much. Let's walk through what are our different options. So option one would be what? Option one might be say no, because you're already with the client, with this client, and you feel like it might be better for the daughter to have somebody completely impartial, right? So say no and refer. Option two would be what? See the daughter?
See the daughter and take one step at a time.
Okay, see the daughter once and see how willing and interested she is, receptive, get a little more information.
What about a consultation?
Say more. What do you mean?
You talk about it. It's Kristen. You talk about a 30-minute consultation or a 15-minute consultation or something like that, just
yeah,
to see if it's a good fit the way you would with any other client.
Yeah. Okay. So see the daughter with a 30-minute consultation. You could see. Let's call that see daughter alone for 30-minute consult. What's another option closely related to that?
Seeing them together?
Yeah, see them together so you can kind of gauge the interaction. And this, you know, would be, if you're somebody that coaches on the phone, that would be one thing. If you're somebody that uses Zoom, you could see both of their faces, and if this was an in-person thing, you could really get a feel for the energy that's happening between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's another option? I think somebody said it earlier. Before I say no completely and refer, I may want to have a specific session with the mom to find out more about, somebody said it earlier, understanding her desire.
About what she wants out of it.
About what she wants out of it, right? Because one option would be to coach the mom to deal with the kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah, so what is her desire about the daughter being in coaching?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I was, my line of thinking was that the mom is
sort of deflecting accountability onto the daughter. And so I'd really want to go deeper into it with her just to make sure from her integrity that she wasn't doing that. She wasn't using her daughter as a sort of method of avoidance.
Right, right. Or because she's really afraid, right? She wants her daughter to get coached because she fears that she's going to lose her too, right? That she'll go live with dad or run away or whatever. And, you know, working through those issues. So we now have four really viable options. And let's just kind of walk through each one. So what are the likely predictable consequences if we say no and make a referral? What might happen? What is the best thing that could happen? What's the worst that could happen? Best thing is the referral works and the daughter gets help from someone else. What's the worst thing if you say no and refer?
You lose your client.
The client may get mad at you and you lose the client. The daughter doesn't go and the client's mad at you and, you know. Okay, so that could happen. We want to take a look at that. Or the client is angry and you have to work through that. What about seeing the daughter alone for a 30-minute consult? What's the best possible consequences and what could go wrong with that? You still there? Everybody's like...
The best is that the teenage girl finds it very helpful. You take her on as another client. Works great. The worst is she gets pissed off and she decides she never wants to come back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. And, you know, another consequence might be that you see her for 30 minutes and realize, oh, she needs, you know, mental health counseling or something else. I mean, that could be just a positive information gathering where you get a real thing on. And, so the best could be she either A, enters into treatment with you, or B, you get a much better idea of what's going on and know what to do, right? Okay, how about see them together? What could potentially happen there? Probably similar to number two, right? You'll get a better idea of what's going on. You might decide to see her or refer her. Worst scenario is they have a big fight and they never come back to you, either one of them, right? Not likely, but, you know, potentially could be a real ignited or you could really clearly see there's a lot of pain between the two of them and they're just not talking. So that could get a conversation going between the two of them. So conversation between the two, discord between them and you, better idea to make referral, decide to see one, not the other. I mean, that's an option that, you know, you decide not to see them both together, but, you know, after the first meeting, say, I'm going to see you one at a time. You know, how do we want to negotiate that? I don't know if that would be the best scenario or decision, but it's a possibility. Okay, what about just seeing the mom and working through this? What are the consequences, potential of that?
That could be the most empowering one for the mom.
Okay, could be most empowering for mom, where you're walking alongside her, empowering her to work with her daughter, right?
Yeah.
Is there a worse scenario of that?
I guess there's the possibility that the daughter genuinely does really have some needs that need to be met, and that may well slip under the radar if you go this way.
Great, really thoughtful response there. Yeah. Okay, so now looking at these options, just saying no and referring, seeing the daughter alone for a consult, seeing them together to see what happens, working with the mom to delve deeper into, you know, what are her desires here and trying to empower her. Each of you just take a moment with your body compass and see what feels the best for you, knowing your expertise and your coaching that you're doing, what feels the best for you. And we may not make the same decision, depending on your experience with the issues or, you know, the kind of coaching that you want to do. And this kind of gets back to how we started the call with ideal client. This something you would want to take on, and that may inform your decision. So does everybody have an idea? Okay, so now let's go to the next question. You have a long relationship with this mom, and she's been doing pretty well, and now this thing has come up with the daughter. And you, looking at your own decision, is that something you feel like could be sort of a universal rule for you, that you would do this if somebody came to you with a family member when they're in crisis? Would this feel like something that you could say, you know, this is my policy on this? And would you feel okay about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, great. So now the light of day. So let's say, you know, this went really well and the person wrote a blog about it, or this didn't go well and the person wrote a blog about it or complained about you somewhere. How would you feel if everybody knew that this is what you decided? Would you be able to say, I thoughtfully looked at all of my options and this is what felt the best to me?
Yeah.
And then now think about, this is the option I've decided, and I'm going to move forward and make the phone call and say, this is what I'd like to propose. How does your body compass feel? Is there any fear or guilt or shoulds that are tugging at you when you think about making, you know, the call to the parent who's asked you this or talking about it in the next session? How does it feel?
Right.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. So I'll stay on just a couple more minutes and just take your thoughts or questions about this process and how you see it working and anything that came up for you as we walk through this.
Thank you because sometimes it's hard to give myself permission to do something that's a little bit different than maybe what the rules are telling me to do. I'm saying that more like social rules, or when you're talking about ethics, you know, it's kind of sometimes a gray scale.
It is gray. It's very gray. A lot of gray areas. Yeah.
So I appreciate that process because it really drilled down to, yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, for myself, that is what I want to do, and it's okay, and it's the best option.
Uh-huh. Great. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good. Somebody else was going to say something.
I just had a question on your sheet here under number 8. Mm-hmm. I think it says, have I worked through any guilt, fear, or any square one story about this situation? And is the square one story what you mean by the blind spot? And, like, have I worked this on my own?
And just sort of like one of the things I've learned with the Brené Brown work is to ask myself, okay, the story I'm telling myself about this is blank, you know, and is that something I need to work through? Like, the story I'm telling myself is, no matter, you know, what I decide, this is going to be horrible. Okay, wait, is that true? And work through that. Or the story I'm telling myself is that I shouldn't work with teenagers because blank, 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 or that kind of thing. Or if I am divorced myself, is there any leftover issue with me and my kids? Let's say. Good question. Anyone else about the process? this would probably be a good place to talk about, just for 1 second, about self-disclosure. So let's say I've been through a divorce and I've had trouble with a kid, and, you know, somebody brought up self-disclosure and when and how to do that. It's a really good question. If I have, you know, put myself out there on my website and my materials as a relationship coach, or, you know, coaching with families going through rough times, there's already sort of self-disclosure in that. So they may have sought you out specifically because of that. And they may say, what did you do? How did you deal with this? And so they may be really seeking self-disclosure from you, which is always fine. I just recently taught a class for the Equus coaches on trauma, and the process that we talked about there was to first use empathy, meaning I want to understand what this experience is like for you. And that's a lot of inquiry, open questions, reflecting back to make sure you are really getting a feel for what that experience is like. Because we may have both been through a loss of a spouse or a divorce or even a broken leg, but your experience might be completely different than mine. So I really want to seek to understand that person's experience, and that is the definition of empathy, is me really seeking to understand what this is like. Level two is really I identify with you because I've been through something similar. Right. If I have never been through divorce, then really empathy is all I have, is to really understand that experience. But I can identify with somebody if I've been through something similar. And in that scenario, I might say, generally speaking, I've been through something similar. I want to hear your experience first, and then I'm happy to share some of the things that helped me. So that's sort of one level of self-disclosure. And then, you know, outright self-disclosure, I'm really careful with that because then it starts to feel like advice. I've been through this and this is what I did. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but if I haven't done the first two first, what can happen is I get into a position of telling them or implying to them that this is what I think is the best thing to do. And though I may have experience and be able to give advice, now I'm getting into something where the client might think, oh my gosh, if I don't do it this way, she's not going to like me, or I'm going to disappoint her or him, you know, that kind of a entanglement. And I don't want to knowingly set that up with my clients.
Or
so
it's wrong.
What's that?
Or I might be doing it wrong.
Yes. And if I do it wrong, or, you know, if it takes me longer than it took you, you're going to think, you know, I'm so lame. I mean, there's so many things that can happen with a client when we just outright give them advice or do self-disclosure that sort of sets up the scenario where they think they need to do it my way. And I don't ever want to do that, because I'm not living their life. They are the expert in their life. So that's sort of my process for self-disclosure, is to really have that be the last tool in my tool belt, to try the other tools first, the inquiry, you know, what are you telling yourself about this? What would happen if you did do that? Those kinds of questions. And if they really are in a dilemma about what to do, and you ask them, well, what do you think your options are here? And they come up with two or three that are Mark, you might say, you know, those are really good options or interesting things to consider. There's a couple of others that I want to add to the list. How would that be for you? Now I've asked permission to provide some other ideas, and then I want to go back to say, well, how does that feel to you when you hear that out loud? Could you see yourself doing something like that? And sort of keep it more third person, like, this is how I did it, and it really worked well. You know, why don't you try that? Kind of a thing. So it's the way that it gets presented in self-disclosure that I think, in asking permission, I'm a lot better off to just add something else to the list versus saying, this is how I did it. I don't know. Hoping that's helpful for you. Can't remember who asked that earlier.
It was me. It's Kristen again. That was me who asked that question. Yes, it's helpful. Thank you. Yeah, especially asking the setting it up first with empathy, and then the the answer to be more general about your experience and why.
Right, and to say I've been through something similar, because we've never been through something exactly the same, usually.
Right.
Even siblings, like I've gone through something that exact same time as my brother, and he has a whole take on it that I don't have, right? Because that's what happened. So it's never really exactly the same.
But I think also that you're the expert in your life, and I'm, you know, it's not, it might not feel the same to you, and those kinds of sort of, you know, openness.
Yeah,
I guess they are invitations to look at it from their point of view, empowering.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Well, we've gone over about 10 minutes, and I appreciate you all staying on the call. And if there's something that you asked that we didn't touch on, you know, can you put it in the forum, and I'll, in our private forum for this group, and I'll answer it. And I'm so excited. You guys are almost through. You're on the last leg of the relay here. So, I'll be hopefully seeing you out there in the coaching world, and, you know, feel free to friend me on Facebook. And, I'm looking forward to seeing how all this pans out for each of you.
Thank you.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Great. Okay. Have a good week.